CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
I just saved hundreds of dollars by switching to GEICO. I feel like I'm on top of the world.
Disclaimer, you will not be transported to the top of the world. In the unlikely event you find yourself at the Arctic Circle, seek shelter from the elements immediately to avoid frostbite and or hypothermia. GEICO will not be responsible if you find yourself in a cave or crevasse with a lonely abominable snowman, who in all likelihood will force you to play games including but not limited to Go Fish, Charades, Chinese Checkers, or his personal favorite, Red Rover, Send Yeti on Over. GEICO is not liable for any damages, either physical or emotional.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Today on Face the Nation, what's ahead in 2018? President Trump is wrapping up a tweet and golf-filled holiday break in Florida, and along the way, he drops some hints about what he wants to get done in the new year. Congress has a to-do list also. To fill us in, we'll talk with South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham and then four members of the House of Representatives. Democrats Joe Crowley of New York and Debbie Dingell of Michigan, and two Republicans, Will Hurd of Texas, and the head of the Conservative Freedom Caucus, Mark Meadows of North Carolina. In an election year, what are their priorities? Before the 2018 midterms take over, what are the chances of fixing health care, resolving the status of so-called dreamers, or getting around to infrastructure spending? After the lawmakers have their say, our political panel will offer its analysis about what's ahead. Then we'll have a conversation with best-selling author J.D. Vance. His book, Hillbilly Elegy, gave America a candid look at that part of our country that helped turn the election for President Trump and still hopes he delivers. It's all ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. John is off today. I'm Major Garrett. 2018 has already arrived in some parts of the world. Here in the U.S., Americans are getting ready to ring in the new year despite extremely cold temperatures in some parts of our country. Security has been increased, as you might expect, at New Year's celebrations across the country. But with temperatures expected to be in single digits or very low double digits in places like Times Square, well, record cold could be more likely than record crowds. We've got a lot to get to today, but we want to take note of the situation in Iran, where anti-government protests continue for the third day. These are the largest demonstrations in the country in almost 10 years. Two protesters were killed overnight. We begin this morning with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. He joins us from Clemson, South Carolina, where I suspect one or two residents have a rooting interest in tomorrow night's Sugar Bowl. Senator, great to have you with us. Let's get straight to the situation in Iran. What is the import of these demonstrations on the street, and what should President Trump do or say about them?
Well, it tells us that the Obama approach of relieving sanctions, hoping the regime would moderate, has failed. The people are not getting the benefit of sanctions relief. They're more upset with their oppressors than ever. The money from sanction relief has gone into rebuilding the Iranian military, and they're destabilizing the Mideast. So if I were President Trump, I would have a nationwide address pretty soon explaining why the Iranian nuclear deal is a bad deal for the world, what a better deal would look like, and urge Congress and the European allies to get a better deal with Iran before it's too late.
And the purpose of that national address would be to take note of this moment and put the United States four square on behalf and behind those people protesting in the streets. Some have said that would be the wrong thing to do because that would give the regime an enemy to point at, us again.
That was the Obama approach. If I were Trump, I'd do the exact opposite of Obama. Obama said, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to mess up the chance of getting a deal with Iran. Well, the deal with Iran hasn't worked. The money didn't go to benefit the people. It went to benefit the Ayatollah and his henchmen. The Iranian people are not our enemy. The Ayatollah is the enemy of the world. Here's what I would do if I was President Trump. I would explain what a better deal would look like. It's not enough to watch. President Trump is tweeting very sympathetically to the Iranian people. But you just can't tweet here. You have to lay out a plan. And if I were President Trump, I'd lay out a plan as to how I would engage the regime. I would tell the Europeans and the Congress and the world that America is going to withdraw from this agreement unless it's a better deal. And I'd lay out what a better deal would look like, and I would stand with the Iranian people the entire time.
Have you conveyed this personally to the president?
I just did.
Okay, very good. Sometimes you could do that by phone, and I'm just curious about that.
Yeah.
North Korea, let's talk about that. You've said recently that if there is another missile test or an nuclear weapons test in North Korea, there's a 70% probability we right. will attack North Korea. 70%. That's a higher risk level than anyone I've talked to has right. placed on that issue. Why is it so high?
I said if there's a nuclear weapons test, it goes from 30% to 70%. It's based on a lot of time with President Trump. He made a decision early on to deny the North Korean regime the capability to hit America with a nuclear-tipped missile. There's two things he could have done. He could have given them the capability to hit America and tell them, if you ever use it, I'm going to blow you off the map. That's called containment. He rejected that idea because you can't contain North Korea. They will sell anything they make if they don't use it. So he's in the camp of denial. He's told the North Koreans, I will deny you the capability to hit America with a nuclear-tipped missile. If they test another bomb, they're closer to having that capability. And as a last resort, I will use military force to stop you. Now, the Iranians are watching us in North Korea. North Korea is watching us in Iran. 2018 will be a year of opportunity and extreme danger. The president has drawn a line in North Korea telling the regime, I will never let you hit America with a nuclear-tipped missile. If I have to, I'll use military force to stop you. Now, the Iranians are watching the way he engages with North Korea and vice versa. So we got a chance here to deliver some fatal blows to really bad actors in 2018. But if we blink, God help us all.
What I hear you saying, Senator, is 2018 is the year of preemptive strikes.
2018 is going to be the year to deny North Korea the capability to hit the homeland. Sanctions will never work completely without the threat of credible military force. How do you change a man's behavior who's willing to kill his own family, torture his own people to stay in power? He's living large, and he could care less about his people. The only way he'll change his behavior if he believes Donald Trump would use military force to destroy his regime. And the Iranians are watching how Trump deals with North Korea. You'll ask me in a minute how my relationship has evolved with the president. It's evolved because he is president of the United States. He beat me like a drum, and I want to help him where I can because there's a lot on this man's plate, and we should all want to help him.
What have you learned about him that makes him different and more someone you want to work with and can work with than he was when you said he was unfit for office and quite possibly a kook?
Yeah, I said everything. I said he was a xenophobic, race-baiting, religious bigot. I ran out of adjectives. Well, the American people spoke. They rejected my analysis, and he is now my president. I worked with President Obama where I could, with President Bush, even though I supported Senator McCain. The bottom line, he is president of the United States. I've got to know him better. He asked a lot of good questions. I think he's made good foreign policy choices. He's now arming the Ukraine, long overdue. He's got the right policy to deny North Korea the ability to hit America with a nuclear-tipped missile, and he is now on the side of the Iranian people. But he has to do more than watch. He actually has to act. And if I were him, I would withdraw from the nuclear agreement with Iran next year if it's not made better by the Congress and our European allies.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes and three topics, Senator.
Okay, healthcare, we can do this.
Healthcare, DACA, and how is Senator McCain?
Senator McCain is in rehab. He's coming back in January. We need his voice now more than ever. Health care, there's a debate between federalism and socialism. I don't know of one Republican who wants to repair Obamacare. I don't know one Democrat who wants to replace it. So we're not going to come together on health care, on DACA. There is a deal to be had. The Dreamers can have the life they've dreamed of if the Democrats and Republicans can give. We need the wall, not a complete 2,200-mile wall. We need border security. You marry that up with the DREAM Act. There's a deal to be had on immigration, and I want to do it in January. I don't want to wait till March.
We've got a minute and a half. That was a lightning round, and you did a spectacular job. So
okay.
The New York Times reported this week that George Papadopoulos, a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign, had a booze-filled encounter in London with an Australian diplomat. And that's where this whole investigation began, not the dossier. You've asked for a special counsel to look into the dossier, its right. evolution, and its import. What does the New York Times reporting this week tell you about that story, and does it make you want to back away from your request for a special counsel into the dossier matter?
No, the dossier, I want somebody to look at how the Department of Justice handled the dossier. As to the Russian investigation, I don't think it hurts our country to look at what Russia did in our election. As a matter of fact, it would hurt us if we ignored it. There's no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians yet, but it will be up to Mr. Mueller to make that decision. Some Democrats want to impeach the president. He's denied any collusion. Here's what I want to happen. Mr. Mueller to do his job without interference, and I want somebody to look at the way the Department of Justice used this dossier. It bothers me greatly the way they used it, and I want somebody to look at it. But 2018, this investigation will go forward. It will be an investigation conducted without political influence. And the president needs to focus on his day job. I need to focus on being a senator. And we all need to let Mr. Mueller do his job. I think he's the right guy at the right time.
Lindsey Graham, Senator of South Carolina, Republican, Happy New Year. And thank you very
Same
much.
To you. Thank you.
For a look at what's on the 2018 congressional agenda, we're joined now by a group of House members, not one, not two, not three, but four, all who have come back to town to join us this morning. We have two Republicans, Congressman Mark Meadows from North Carolina, chairman of the conservative group in the House known as the Freedom Caucus. His colleague Will Hurd is from Texas, and our Democrats this morning, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell from Michigan and Congressman Joe Crowley from New York, a member of the House Democratic leadership. Happy New Year. Thanks
Happy
for
New
joining
Year to
us.
You.
So I'm going to go around the table very quickly with a kind of an opening question. Debbie, we'll start with you. We'll go around. What do you consider the most important agenda item for Congress from your perspective, and what will 2018 look like outside of politics in a successful year?
Well, first of all, I think we've got to try to work with each other because there are a lot of things that we've got to deliver for the American people. So I don't say that I'm not going to work with anybody. We clearly have to get a budget passed in January and make it long term. But there are so many other subjects. We've got to worry about pensions, health care. I've been living in a hospital for the last 2 weeks with my husband. I cannot tell you how many people come to my room crying and scared to death. And we have to do DACA.
And your husband is former Congressman John Dingell. How's he doing?
He's doing okay. He's stubborn, ornery, and twittering.
Very good. That's a good combination. Joe Crowley.
Well, I think...
Give me one thing that would define this as successful.
There's more than one
year.
Thing. I think for Democrats, we're concerned about certainly pension protection, which is a major issue for us. Also, the Dreamers, the DACA issue, the issue of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, and making sure that those Americans are made whole.
House passed the bill. Senate has not.
And also, the other piece of this is, I think, what we're going to fight against, and that is the privatization of Social Security. It's going to be the diminishment of Medicare and Medicaid. We know that's on the block for our Republican colleagues in the House. Certainly, Paul Ryan has said that. I know Mark Meadows and others have also
teed that up
as well. And that's something we're concerned about, very, very concerned about happening again.
Will Hurd.
National security. Major, as you know, I spent 9.5 years as an undercover officer in the CIA. You led off the show talking about Iran. Iran is a real threat to the rest of the world. This is something that we can get together as Republicans and Democrats, you know, and support and work together on. We need to make sure that our European allies in Germany and France and England are following President Trump's lead and showing that they support the Iranian people. You know, we need to make sure that we're showing the rest of the world what's really happening in Iran, because the Iranian government is trying to shut down the internet. They're trying to stop people from talking because there is a proxy war going on right now between Iran and our allies, Saudi Arabia, in Israel, and that can become a hot war, and that's going to be dangerous for everybody. We've been focusing a lot on North Korea. As long as two countries are talking, you know, the fact that there are direct conversations with North Korea is something that hasn't been highlighted, but a proxy war turning into a hot war is something that we have to be worried about in 2018.
Do you agree with Senator Graham that the president should give a national address on this? And is there something, speaking of your past life, covertly we should be doing
well,
at this moment?
It starts with, there's going to be plenty of time to talk about how this, you know, what this means for the Iran deal. But the first step is to show that we're united in supporting the Iranian people and their ability to peacefully protest. It is written in the Iranian Constitution that people can peacefully protest. We should be supporting that. We should be encouraging our allies to ensure that the Iranians are allowing that, and that the Iranians crack down. And these two deaths are because of Iranian security officials. It's because of the Basij. It's because of the IRGC. If we allow this to continue, that's where we should be talking about sanctions, because these are human rights abuses, and we should be unified and show the Iranian people we stand with them.
Mark Meadows.
You know, I think it's really about what matters to moms and dads on Main Street. We need to continue to grow the economy. If we look at 2017, historic from a standpoint of tax reform, consumer confidence at a 17-year high. We've got a stock market that is creating wealth again. Going beyond that, though, what we need to make sure is that we build on the successes. You know, we've got a president that actually made an unbelievable foreign policy decision that I support. moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, something that he'll be defined for centuries as the only president who was willing to take the intestinal fortitude to do that. So we've got to build on those successes. I think what we will see is a real push to make the tax cuts for individuals permanent. I think you'll see a vote on that in the first 30 days of this new year for those moms and dads on Main Street. I think the other part of that that you'll see is that there's going to be a real battle over what do we grow? Do we grow the economy? Or do we grow government? And right now, I can tell you, it does not look well. It looks like we're going to spend more money on growing the government in January than perhaps the biggest amount of money that we spent since the Obama stimulus plan. And that's a concern for conservatives.
So to break that down for our audience, to pass a budget and to reach the deficit, I mean, the defense spending threshold the president has outlined, Democrats will ask Republicans and this president to raise the domestic spending caps as well. And without Democratic support in the Senate, you can't pass a budget. How is this going to be resolved?
Well, and I think the real question is what is reasonable? The administration has already been willing to say we're going to increase non-defense discretionary spending, which is that amount of money outside of the military, by about 7%. Now, Democrats are saying, well, that's not enough. We need to give the government a pay raise of 10 to 11%. For a fiscal conservative, I don't see where the rationale is. You know, we've got people on Social Security and making a living who maybe have seen a 2%, 3% increase, and now we're going to give the government 11% more. You know, eventually you run out of other people's money.
Is there a better way to spend your New Year's Eve morning than with four members of the House of Representatives? I assure you there simply is not. Debbie Dingell, Joe Crowley, Democrats both, walk us through the Democratic point of view on putting together a budget, raising non-defense spending in ways the president can get happy with his defense spending increase.
Well, I would first say to you that I don't totally agree on the approach on Iran, but I do agree we've got to support the Iranian people, and that's the most important thing we need to do. And national security is without question our number one priority. A third of our national security budget is in the non-defense spending. And we need to be worried about that. And we do. The President Trump, I was one of the people that said President Trump could win this election. And I said it because American people are angry. Sure. They're tired of the partisan bickering and they want to see us get things done. But they're scared. They haven't lost that anxiety and that fear that's in their souls from the last time the market collapsed. You've got people, the West Virginia, my people in my district who worked a lifetime, put money into their pension. They're retiring. Suddenly the money's not there. We've got a moral responsibility to figure this out.
You've both mentioned pensions. What are you talking about with Congress dealing with pensions? What do you want to see happen? What legislation are we talking about?
Well, there is a bill right now named after a Teamster who died in Ohio trying to fight for this, which actually would not ultimately cost the government money. It would be a way of funding a way to bonds, like municipal bonds, but it's a
backup pension obligation.
Backup pension.
Long term.
And we need to do something. I mean, these are people, these guys are, they're crying in my arms.
No, we bailed out the banks. We need to bail out the individuals who were hurt tremendously by that the 08 crash.
Who lost pension.
Lost pensions.
Allowances and guarantees.
Who have less than half their pension coming to them that they were getting.
As a result of the Great Recession.
Yep. In part, in great part. But let me just add what Debbie said about the budget itself. A third of the domestic spending is on defense. It's on Homeland Security. And I think that's given short shrift by our Republican colleagues. But I will say this, and it's interesting to hear Mark talk about, you know, fiscal responsibility. Here we just passed, we just refinanced the mortgage of the United States House. And in doing so, we borrowed $1.5 trillion.
You mean for the tax cut bill?
We did with the tax cut bill. We did not put that money into our kids' college accounts or help them pay for college. We didn't improve the infrastructure of our house. Instead, what we did, we gave one of the largest tax cuts to the wealthiest multinational corporations in the world. And you know, talk about fiscal responsibility. This is one of the most least responsible fiscal responsible bills we've ever seen pass in the House of Representatives. And I think we're going to be paying for this for many, many years to come.
I want Will and Mark on taxes real quick, and then I want to get to DACA.
Well, I'll disagree with my friend from New York City. The tax cut that we just passed, historic in its nature, is going to allow more Americans to keep their money and not send it up here to Washington, D.C. It's going to allow people to invest in the future of their children by investing in education. And when we talk about making sure that people have a strong footing in their retirement, the fact that we're seeing the highest stock market ever, and now you have this opportunity with supercharging the economy with tax cuts, this is good for everyone. This means increasing wages. This is good economic. This is about economic growth. That's going to help to make sure that people's financial future are secure.
Well, and so let me back up, because Joe's running to an old talking point. We can go to your Twitter feed. I think it's what Major CBS at Major CBS just before Christmas, where there's an interview with a single mom from Cary, North Carolina, making $40,000 a year. And you had a CPA from New York actually do her taxes. She's getting $1,300 back. And so to suggest that it's just the rich that are getting it, over 91%. So 9 out of 10 viewers that are watching this right now are getting money back. And it's not our money. It's their money. And what we need to do is trust them to spend it. They will spend it better than the government.
This tax bill is overly weighted towards the wealthiest of the country. That's not even arguable.
And we're going to talk about DACA right now. And we're going to try to work this out right here and right now. The president said, Joe Crowley and Debbie Dingell, DACA can be done, but there has to be money for the wall, and there has to be an end-of-chain migration and something done on the visa reform as part of immigration. Those are the terms set forth by the president, acceptable or unacceptable.
We need to do DACA clean.
By itself.
These young kids, they were here during Christmas. They're desperate. They've spent a lifetime here. We should not be bogging this down with subjects we need to talk about. Border security is important. How we do it, we probably need to have a lot of discussion.
But Congressman Crowley, the president wants to leverage your desire for DACA and his willingness to accept it, to codify it in law, which President Obama did not do. Yeah. But he wants in exchange his priorities, and he was elected president. Why should he get them?
The president is like a volunteer fireman here who starts his own fire and then tells everyone else how to put it out. The reality is the president created this fire. He unwound
the executive. That's not true. It's because President Obama actually did DACA. He did the deferral. This president actually took action when the courts were going to do it.
The DACA
Joe,
executive
it's just order. Not true. It's Mark, just not
Let me answer the question. He created this situation, and now he's saying in order to get to take care of these souls who are American citizens, not American citizens,
they are American citizens
in every way. They are cultural Americans. They know no other way of life than being here, and they love this country, and they want to remain here in the United States. And what the president's saying, in order to do that, we have to build a $40 billion wall that you can't drive on, you can't live in, and it's an incredible waste of American resources.
Hard time. We got 30 seconds, Will Hurd. The obligation
we can do
is yours.
This. We can do this together, but we have to do this together. We can have smart solutions to border security, and we can solve this problem in a narrow fashion for these dreamers who have only known the United States of America as their home. The good thing is nobody's talking about deporting a million kids. And so
they are talking about deporting families and them as well.
Reasonable and who's going to
solve this
problem.
The president's not being reasonable
here. I'm dealing with ICE every day in my district.
Debbie? Joe, Will, Mark, first name only basis, we're going to deal with it that way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Major.
Happy New Year to you all.
Happy New Year.
And we will be right back.
Attention shoppers, clean up on aisle 14. Clean up on aisle 14. Someone dropped a jar of pickles. Pickles.
Beatboxing at a big box store. Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to Geico.
A red minivan has the lights on in the parking lot.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Geico.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm Major Garrett. I'm in for John Dickerson. We turn now to our political panel. Julie Pace is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Ed O'Keefe covers Congress and politics for the Washington Post and is a CBS News contributor. We're also joined by Rachel Bade. She covers Congress for Politico. And David Nakamura, White House reporter for the Washington Post and, as am I, a proud graduate of the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to you all and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Julie, let me start with you. The president told the New York Times recently that he thought Special Counsel Robert Mueller would be fair. And he didn't seem to express, given the opportunity, all of the hostility some Republicans in Congress in the late waning months of December expressed toward the special counsel, his staff, his motives? What does this tell us, if anything, about where the White House actually is on this and the never-ending question in Washington, where is the Russia investigation?
Well, for months, the president has been hearing from two different camps on Bob Mueller. He's been hearing from some of his outside advisors, the people who have been around him for years, who say that he needs to be tougher on Bob Mueller. That
he needs a better legal team.
He needs a better legal team. He needs to be more aggressive in going after what a lot of these friends and advisors of the president see as the politically motivated investigation by Bob Mueller. But then there are the White House lawyers, people like Ty Cobb, John Dowd, who have been saying to the president that he actually would be in a stronger position if he let this investigation run its course. And so at least in that moment, that's where the president seemed to be. He seemed to be taking the advice of those lawyers. I think heading into 2018, the thing to watch is going to be how Trump reacts to the reality that this investigation is not going to be over quickly. Those same lawyers have been telling him that this is winding down. All evidence points to the contrary, that this is an investigation that is still robust, that is still pursuing new avenues, and how the president reacts, how fair he thinks Mueller is being when he realizes that this could consume a second year of his presidency, could really change the direction of this administration in 2018.
Rachel, the president said the investigation is not good for the country. It doesn't make it look, makes it look bad. Mm-hmm. Is it burdening Congress? Is it becoming something that Congress doesn't know what to do with or can't bring to conclusion?
Republicans feel it's certainly a distraction from their legislative agenda. Of course, they would rather be talking about tax reform than what's the latest turn in the Russia investigation screws. Look, the whole thing with the president saying, you know, that the investigation is going to be fair, it's kind of interesting when you sort of compare it with what his allies on the Hill are doing in terms of trying to discredit the investigation.
Preemptively discredit it.
Right, before we see the conclusions. And just in the past week or so, we've seen, you know, we've heard news about a sort of secret House Republican investigation led by Trump ally Devin Nunes, who leads the House Intelligence Committee panel. And this is basically a probe of whether there's corruption in the FBI. And they're also talking about, you know, senior FBI officials and want to ask them about any contacts they have with journalists. So, you know, Trump might be setting back and saying, I'm going to, you know, be neutral here. I'm going to let Mueller do his job. But he's letting, you know, his allies on the Hill do his dirty work.
He's also setting framework in that same interview where he said, 16 times there was no collusion. He seems to be suggesting that he will be treated fairly, assuming there's a certain outcome. And I think one point that Julie made is really important, which is that in that same interview, Trump also acknowledged that he doesn't know when this investigation will end. And it's something where his own lawyers had told him Thanksgiving, then Christmas, then definitely by the end of the year. That does not seem to be happening, and the president seemed to acknowledge that.
And it's incredible that the party that has been built on law and order and has been supported by law enforcement and first responders in this country really for most of this century is now going after the preeminent law enforcement agency in this country. And I think one thing to remember is you've got thousands of FBI personnel all across the country. They will respond today to crimes far outside of Washington. And to be going after them in this way has a real risk for the Republican Party, I think, going into the midterms this year. You're going to need those types of people to turn out for Republican candidates. And if they're going after the FBI in this way, you wonder whether or not that affects their support.
And yet, if some of those Republicans who've raised these concerns were sitting at this table, they would say, look, it's not the FBI we're going after. We're going after people who have text messages that are at least problematic.
Right.
In what they say about their political orientation and what it might mean for them as investigators. And you have an FBI process dealing with Hillary Clinton that was outside of what would be regarded as normal protocol. I'm not saying that. Lots of people who are experts in the law have looked at this and said, there's some questions that need to be answered here. Can you raise this in a way that gets to some of those answers without inviting the political risk you just suggested?
And that's going to be a really tricky balancing act for those Republicans who want to start this up on Capitol Hill in the coming year, for
and
sure.
You might see a split, I would guess.
We're already starting among Republicans on this.
Exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
Lindsey Graham, just a few minutes ago in interviewing with you, said he wants Mueller to continue to do his job. I mean, watch people like him and compare him with Devin Nunes, who's going to be really aggressive on this in terms of saying that there is corruption and bias at the FBI. But there's a lot of Republicans on the Hill who are not comfortable with that. And so that split is just going to grow wider and wider.
Julie, you heard the rather lively conversation we had among our four members of Congress, two Republicans, two Democrats, about DACA, about the Dreamers, deferred adjudication for childhood arrivals.
it seemed to me that that was just a preliminary round. I mean, that this is going to get very intense, absolutely, and the politics of it are going to get white hot almost instantly.
Absolutely. This is going to be the big issue to watch on Capitol Hill heading into 2018 because it's so emotional and it's so personal for so many people. And because most lawmakers in both parties would like to have a solution to this problem. Republicans don't want to be the party that let a million young people who came to this country be as children be deported. But they also are looking to the president for some guidance on how hard he's going to be on the marker he has laid down, which is, I will give you DACA if you give me a border wall. One thing I've heard from Democrats is some worry that they will let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. Some Democrats are open to the idea that you could give on border security, give on technology at the border, something that would allow the president to save face with his base, go forward and say, look at all of this that I got for border security, even if it's not a physical wall. But again, if you heard Debbie Dingell, she wants clean DACA.
Yeah.
That seems like that is going to be an impossible
Separating
position.
Those issues no entirely.
Separating those issues. That seems like an impossible position for Democrats.
And that, to me, Ed, seems like a near suicide mission for the White House if it were to go that route, because it would invite amnesty, rolling over, giving in, and abandoning the things that were central to your campaign message.
Let's remember on the calendar, you have January 19th, which is when the next spending bill expires and when they want to come up with a solution to this problem. Otherwise, March 5th
the next semi-shutdown drama.
Right, exactly. And then March 5th is the deadline for DACA. Did you hear anyone present a specific proposal here this morning?
Or a timeline.
No,
that's
you didn't.
Even mildly rational.
They're nowhere near an agreement on this. Mm-hmm. And I think, as Julie was saying, the real breaking point here is going to be once they put down what the compromise is for DACA, okay, we're going to save these kids. And they're not just kids.
And they're not
all kids. They're adults.
Many of them are adults.
Anywhere between 640,000 and 1.8 million people. Once they figure that out, okay, what are you going to get in return? Yeah. I'm less interested in what the Republican response to that will be than the Democratic response. But a lot of these congressmen from immigrant districts, L.A., Chicago, New York, are going to go home. And if these people are told, you're getting your status, but we're also going to do all these other things, the backlash for Democrats could be quite
severe.
Backlash
is important, but I think the president has been all over the map on this. He talked earlier when he announced ending DACA that we could do border separately. We could do a border wall separately. Now he's talking about the wall again in this interview.
Not just that, but chain migration.
Chain migration.
Yeah, other things.
Chain migration.
He's adding to the ledger.
Things like the visa diversity lottery. It's 50,000 a year for certain countries that don't have a lot of immigrants coming here. Things like that have been talked about being eliminated in the past. They've been in bills in the 2013 bill. These are not new ideas. Right. Some of these could happen in this round. But I think the border wall is something that Democrats just look as important to them saying no on something like this as it is for Trump and his base to get some start on that.
And Rachel, we saw right before Congress left town, House members go into Chuck Schumer's office and sort of try to read him the riot act for not standing up on this issue.
Right.
I mean, these tensions are real right now.
Yeah, there's certainly a split not only with the Democrats about how much to demand in return for DACA, but also with the Republicans in terms of how much to demand for DACA. But the Democrats as well, in terms of should they have held the line before Christmas and getting this fixed. Just to sort of illustrate how difficult this issue is, I was speaking with Mike Kaufman, who is this Republican from a swing state district in California, has a lot of immigrants and Dreamers in his own district. And he was telling me the week before Christmas, this center moderate group of Republicans and Democrats, they call themselves the problem solvers, and they get together and they try to do bipartisan solutions when everybody else is at each other's throats. They were supposed to unveil some sort of DACA agreement the last week before Christmas, and it came together. They had something, and it just ended up blowing up. It fell through, and this just shows that if these people who are moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans, cannot come together, sit in a room, and come up with a solution, how are Republican and Democratic leaders going to fix this?
Problem Solvers Caucus becomes Lump of Coal Caucus right before Christmas. Ed O'Keefe, there are obligations Congress has early in the new year, and then there are intentions. I would say infrastructure is an intention.
Yeah.
Entitlement reform is an intention. Obligations are fund the government, deal with DACA, resolve something that increases defense spending along the lines that President Trump wants and has obsessively advertised but not yet achieved. And then what do you do on the domestic side of the ledger? And we saw that teased out on this panel as well. Very tough lines to be drawn there. Help our audience understand what are some of the markers, the deadlines, and what are some of the things to watch for?
Well, the first
one, let us know if things are going to come together or remain pulled
apart. Yeah, I think January 19th, again, the next potential shutdown date, is a good marker of how quickly they either want to get their unfinished business done or continue to have those fights.
Do you think that's going to be a time where the budget's going to be, or is that going to be another month continuing resolution to find more time to negotiate and
if one of my resolutions in 2017 was to not make too many predictions based on the success of 2016, I'd say the only thing I'd say is if you don't get it done by January 19th, use the President's Day recess as the next potential marker, so maybe it spills another month. But you got a lot of things there. You've got, again, the DACA situation. You've got to set budget caps, or how much more will you raise spending by the government. There's a host of other things. Issues with the Children's Health Insurance Program. It's running out of money in several states. And then, as Mark Meadows was floating there, the idea that you might extend permanently those individual tax cuts. Do you use this bill as another way to get that done? Because there's only so many vehicles that sort of leave the station, as we like to say,
right,
that are guaranteed to pass. And so you try to tack on things to sweeten it for certain people. That may be one that he's floating.
And, Julie, there's already talk of Republicans not only trying to make the individual tax cuts permanent, but do other technical fixes and do that under reconciliation, which is another one of these mechanisms where simple majority in the House, it's always that way, but a simple majority in the Senate is rarely that way. But you have to pass a budget to do that. To do that, you have to get agreement on other things like entitlements and other spending that Republicans are not aligned on. Is that something to keep an eye on as well?
It absolutely is. Republicans are part of the reason that we didn't get a budget at the end of 2017 is because Republicans aren't aligned, and then they can't figure out how to get some of these Democrats on board that they would need to get 60 votes in the Senate. I think the Meadows idea today is just fascinating. This idea of going back and saying, let's make in the tax bill, you had permanent tax cuts for corporations and you had tax cuts for individuals that would expire. It would put a lot of pressure, frankly, on Democrats to say no to a permanent tax cut extension for individuals.
Bernie Sanders said just last week they should have all been permanent.
They should have all been permanent. So now the Republicans may try to have those Democrats kind of put their money on the table, put their cards on the table on how far they're willing to go, even though they obviously are opposed to the full bill.
David, what is your sense of the political clout of President Trump as he enters 2018? About what it was on Inauguration Day? Slightly diminished, slightly enhanced.
What's interesting is his poll numbers have gone down, you know, a significant amount in terms of public approval ratings. But the way he has sort of consolidated some of the levers of power in the White House and sort of wielded his clout and his unpredictable nature and his ability just to attack and relentlessly attack his opponents, I think maintains his clout. I mean, he's picked the wrong horse in the Alabama Senate race twice, but the president continues to strike fear into folks who are running for re-election, not to get on his bad side, and those on Capitol Hill who still want to see the Republican agenda move forward. So he, in some ways, I think, retains more clout than someone with those poll numbers might normally suggest, especially this sort of historic lows in the first year.
Rachel, journalists answer hypothetical questions all the time. Politicians do not. So let me ask you a hypothetical question. Imagine we're looking into a House Republican conference meeting, and they're all sitting there in their seats, and Paul Ryan says, all right, raise your hand if you want Donald Trump to campaign with you in 2018. How many hands go up?
How many hands? I would say about 80 to 90.
Mm-hmm. Would those all be in districts
of Republicans,
that
would
be
say.
Really up for grabs, or would they be super safe districts that they would just love to see the president there anyway because they're already in lockstep and it's pretty safe?
I would say the safe districts for sure because,
right,
you know, these are the folks who actually, you know, where the president does have clout on the Hill, it is with these Republicans from these safe districts who, you know, they want to be connected to him at the hip because their base, the base still loves the president. And, you know, these are Republican districts. So, of course, the swing states are totally, or the swing districts are a totally different story, right? I mean, the president with his approval ratings going down, they don't want to be anywhere near him.
30 seconds, Julie Pace. The White House is talking about a revamping of its political operation. Is it overdue?
It probably is overdue. There hasn't been a particularly robust political operation, as David pointed out.
It's only Trump, basically.
It's basically only
the
Trump.
President.
It's basically Trump. He's going on instinct. He listens to some people on the outside, less of his political advisors on the inside. They're heading into a year where they're trying to convince the president now that the 2018 midterms are going to be incredibly consequential for his ability perhaps to even finish 4 years in office. If that message gets through to him, I think he will see a true revamp of that political office.
That is one very, very big F. Julie Pace, Ed O'Keefe, David Nakamura, Rachel Bade, thank you so much. We'll be back in a moment with author, best-selling author, J.D. Vance.
CBS News Radio podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great shows like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all from your Spotify app on your iOS or Android device. CBS News Radio on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS News Radio podcasts today.
We sat down recently with J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy. Now, Vance's book has been credited with identifying the so-called forgotten Americans who helped carry Donald Trump to his unexpected victory. A year into the Trump administration, Vance warns those voters might well be disappointed if the president's rhetoric doesn't match reality.
I started writing the book back in 2013, and of course no one at that time, certainly not me, knew what we were going to see with the nomination and then, the election of Donald Trump. So definitely thought that when the book was coming out, and this is June of 2016, hard to believe it's been that long, I thought that a lot of folks would be trying to ask questions about who the Trump voter was. And of course, that's a little bit about what my book is about. I don't mention Donald Trump, but I certainly talk a lot about people living in a certain part of the country, people from a certain demographic segment who did overwhelmingly support the president, both in the nominating contest, but also, of course, in the general election.
For that community that you write about in the book and that you grew up in, what do you think those larger truths are that they heard that he spoke to in ways they hadn't heard before?
Well, I think one of the most important larger truths that he spoke to is the importance of jobs in the life of the community. If you think about Republican rhetoric, let's say, during the campaign of Mitt Romney, very focused on the noble entrepreneur, very focused on the job creator, but not so much on the worker. And if you think of the rhetoric of modern Democrats, it's often so focused on government that people don't accept, or that I think a lot of folks on the left don't appreciate that people don't want a handout, they don't want government support, and they don't, from the right, want people to talk about the noble entrepreneur. What they want is people to recognize the dignity of working people. And I think that what was genius about the politics of Trump's campaign is that he focused on workers and he focused on jobs. It wasn't about the wealthy entrepreneur with a private jet. It wasn't about a government handout. It was about the folks in the middle.
In the conversation about the tax bill, as sure. An example, he doesn't talk about supply-side economics. He doesn't talk about any theory at all.
When the president talks about tax reform, he talks about the people who will benefit. He talks about American jobs. He talks about the fact that we're going to be taking money that's overseas and bring it back to the United States so that it will employ American workers. I think that focus, again, on the American working and middle class is to me, the most thoughtful and in some ways the most genius part of Trump's approach to politics.
And I will tell you, having attended more than 75 Trump rallies, there were times when I would laugh to myself when he would say, every dream you've ever dreamed is going to come true, and America's going to get back winning again. I thought, oh, come on, this even by political standards, this is sort of cotton candy taken to the maximum level. And yet, having read your book, it occurs to me the concept of putting winning or victory central to it, to people who maybe feel like they've either become losers or forgotten. That was much more powerful than I thought or imagined at the time. Do you think that's possible?
Yeah, well, I think that sense of loss is really important. The idea that 30 or 40 years ago, things were really going well, and now they've started to disintegrate, not just our work life, but our family life and a lot of other issues on top of that.
Do you think there is a danger for Trump going forward, the president going forward, and these voters, that his rhetoric and their expectations may never match?
I think that that's certainly a concern. It's a political concern for the Trump administration, but it's a concern for Americans.
It's a ground level concern.
Absolutely. It's a concern for a lot of folks who really do expect things to get a whole lot better. One of the things I really worry about is that if you don't see middle class wage growth, if you don't see the economy in certain areas of the country, the middle part of the country, starting to come back in the same way that it's doing, especially well, let's say, in California or New York, then people are going to become politically frustrated, but more importantly, they're going to have a lot of hope stashed, the sense that maybe this is the moment, this is the electoral moment where a lot of our fortunes turn around, that's going to disappear, and consequently, folks are going to be pretty upset about it.
And part of your next phase of life is to deal with this.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that I'm working on with Steve Case is this Rise of the Rest initiative that I'm pretty passionate about. If you look at where the net job growth comes, it comes from high growth startup companies. And unfortunately, you don't see a lot of high growth startup companies outside of California, New York, and Boston, Massachusetts. And so what we're trying to do is in some ways democratize access to capital, invest in areas that don't get as much entrepreneurial investing, and hopefully start to create some of those new 21st century jobs in places that don't see that job creation.
And in my travels, I've seen a little bit of that in Des Moines, sure. Iowa. I've seen a little bit of that in Omaha, Nebraska. Yep. It's not as if it doesn't exist in exactly. quote-unquote flyover country, but you want to accelerate.
Yeah, exactly. It certainly exists. There are certainly really exciting pockets of entrepreneurship all across the
country.
Usually
linked to a university of some kind.
Exactly. You know, universities provide high-quality talent. They provide intellectual property necessary for folks to get their businesses off the ground. But you still don't see nearly as much investment in these areas, even though you see pockets of hope, right? So the statistic I throw out is 50% of venture capital goes to California. Most of the rest of it goes to New York and Massachusetts. That means there's 47 states fighting over a very small amount of the type of investment that creates really high quality, long-term durable jobs. And so if you can rearrange that, if you can create more entrepreneurship and more investment in some of these areas, are you going to fix all the problems I wrote about in Hillbilly Elegy? No, but you will start to create some more high-quality job growth.
And then this brings us back to some of the embedded behavioral problems you write about in Hillbilly Elegy, and those are going to have to change even if this capital arrives.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
You speak quite candidly
sure.
about laziness and people who think they work but don't actually work, and that they're part of this equation, and that reckoning is going to have to occur, number one, and won't be easy to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you go to a town like Middletown, Ohio, where some people are struggling to find a job, but then there are people who had a good job and lost it, not because the economy was bad, but because they made mistakes. You see both types of people, and I think we have to recognize that there are these twin impulses that exist. There is a need for more economic growth, for more job growth, but there is a need in some people for them to recognize that they have a role in making these problems better, and we can't ignore that. The issue that's really, really concerning is that you have 8 million prime-age men who have dropped out of the labor force, folks who aren't even looking for work. You can create job growth all day, but unless you start to do the things that bring those labor force dropouts back into the job market, you're not going to solve the problems I wrote about in the book.
J.D., thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Major.
That's it for us today. We thank you so very much for watching. We wish all of you a very happy and very safe New Year. John will be back next week. I'm Major Garrett, and this has been Face the Nation. Today's guests were Senator Lindsey Graham, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, and Congressman Mark Meadows, Will Hurd, and Joe Crowley. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsman. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday. And for a recap of all the week's news, subscribe to our Face the Nation Diary podcast, available every Friday night.